Hey, I know what'll cheer you up.
Welcome to the Bright Ideas Podcast, where we let proven experts help you to find the next bright idea to implement in your business today. And now, here's your host, Trent Deersmith.
This is unbelievable. This true force has never been fully understood.
Hey there, Bright Idea Hunters. Welcome back to episode number 136 of the Bright Ideas Podcast. I am your host, Trent Deersmith. And this is the podcast where we help entrepreneurs to discover ways to use digital marketing and marketing automation to dramatically increase the growth of their businesses. If you are an entrepreneur looking for proven tactics and strategies to help you grow traffic, increase conversions, and attract more clients, well, my friends, you are in the right place. And the way that we do that is I bring on proven entrepreneurs to share with me and you exactly this tactics and strategies that they're using on a day-to-day basis to build the business that they are running right now. In other words, we're not here talking about theory. When you listen to one of my podcasts, it's like sitting in on a coffee conversation or a meeting or anything where I am literally grilling that CEO to tell me exactly what they're doing to grow the business. And this interview is no different. My guest is a woman by the name of Kathy Leek, who is running a company called Local Response. This is a venture-backed company in the ad tech space. It's her second one. Her first one is still wildly successful. She's still an owner of that company, but went on to start another one, and for reasons that she'll explain in this interview. And they've gone from zero to over $10 million in their first 3 years and are on track to double revenue in the year that they are currently in. So in this interview, we're going to be talking about all sorts of things like, what is ad tech? What is this technology? How are they using commercial intent shared on social media? And how does all the data get collected? And what do the brands do with it? And why is it important? We're also going to talk about how they generate leads for themselves and how their sales team operates and how they're using email to open the door and get in and get meetings with major corporations. We're going to talk about the fundraising process, which she's been now through twice. Back in 2008 was the first time, and then in the last quarter of 2011, the second time. And there's just so many great golden nuggets that you're going to experience when you listen to this interview. So we're going to get to it in just a second. Before I do that, very quickly, I get a lot of emails from people asking me, Trent, what are the tools and resources that you use to run your businesses? And I've made a list of all of them, and you can get that list at grabtrentsbonus.com. So what's with the funny URL? Well, as the name suggests, when you use, and some of those things on the list, by the way, are affiliate links. So when you use one of my affiliate links to go and buy, you know, lead pages, the landing page software or infusion software, whatever it is that you're going to get, they will send me a little bit of a commission for referring you to them as a new customer. And so as my thank you to you, when you do that, if you send me your receipt, I have a number of bonuses that are my paid products that I will give you for free as a thank you for using my affiliate link. So you can get all the info at grabtrentsbonus.com. So with that said, please join me in welcoming a very, very smart entrepreneur by the name of Kathy to the show. Hey, Kathy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, no problem. It's a pleasure to have you here to tell the story of how you have built Local Response so incredibly quickly from nothing into a 10-plus million-dollar a year business. And I have no doubt that a large number of people in my audience are going to want to hear the details of how you did that. So before we get into that, as I'm sure many of them do not yet know who you are or even what Local Response is, let's set the table for the discussion with a quick intro of who you are and what you do.
That sounds great. So my name is Kathy, and I have about 20 years of experience on the ad age side of the business, and I decided to become become an entrepreneur in late 2007. And since then, I have built two companies, both in the ad tech space, ad targeting companies or ad networks, for lack of a better term. My first company was called Media 6 Degrees. It's been rebranded to Distillery, and that company is, you know, now doing north of $50 million in revenue, worth, you know, over $140 million in valuation. So once I felt like that was off on its trajectory, I decided to build another company, and it's a company I'm currently building, which is Local Response. and we've been around since March 2011. And as you said, we're north of $10 million in that short time frame, which is very much the trajectory that I like to see in ad tech. So really my passion is taking new methods of targeting to market to serve brands and agencies.
So before we get into all of the details around that, the question as I was listening to you talk that popped into my mind was, why have two ad tech companies? Why? Because I'm assuming, are you still in any way, shape, or form involved or own any of the previous one?
Great question. So when I did decide to, I had a career transition in late 2007. I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do next. With 20 plus years on the agency side of the business, the only choices you have are to maybe start your own agency or work at the holding company level of an agency or a holding company group. And so for me, I realized that I wanted to look at ad tech because of the multiples for exits for companies that are building technology is just so much infinitely higher than building a services business, like starting your own agency. So that was a choice that I made then, but I also wanted to treat my career like a VC treats a portfolio and looking at how I can build multiple companies over, starting in 2007, over the next 10 to 15 years of my career, I wanted to have vested interests in multiple companies that I build. So my first startup, I have equity in the company. And so now, once I was fully vested, I felt free to build another company and have a vested interest in another company. And of course, I plan to do this again multiple times.
And so are these two companies more or less direct competitors to one another?
That's a good question. I would say in the general sense, we are competing for ad dollars from brands mm-hmm. and agencies, but we don't compete with regards to our offering. So what I'm now doing at Local Response is an evolution of my last company, which is really what I like to represent in the marketplace, creating companies that are an evolution of the last one. And Local Response is focused on analyzing commercial intent through social media and basically taking that data and turning it into targetable impressions for brands. So our position is different than my first company. But like I said, in a general sense, we're all competing for ad dollars.
Okay. So when you started that first, as I asked you in the pre-interview, you're not a coder or you weren't when you finished up your career at the agency. You weren't a technical person per se, correct?
True. So, I definitely don't. I don't consider myself to be a technologist. However, I do have the ability to adapt and learn very quickly. I actually think I thrive when I don't understand something. I just figure out ways to learn. And I had a lot to learn about ad tech when I did cross over from the services side into the technology side. But I would say I fell in love with technology and data in particular. This is something that I really, really love and have kind of geeked out on since I crossed over.
So when you were starting the first company and you wanted to make this transition, one of the things that I'm deeply curious about is, so software companies tend to be pretty expensive to start, especially if they're going to build a robust platform that can scale as quickly as you have done. So here you are, this agency person, you're not a technical person. Did you partner up with a couple of other very technical people, build a prototype, get a couple of customers, and then go talk to VCs and you got funded and things kind of kept going? If it wasn't that, what was it?
Yeah, it was definitely, I definitely need a tech partner in this game. So for every company that I plan to build, I will need someone that is a true technologist by my side to partner with. And in the first instance, the kernel of the idea actually came from an engineer, and they brought me in to figure out if the idea was viable. Is it commercially viable? If it is, what should we call it? How should we position it? Mm-hmm. Could I take it to market? Could we be successful? So I was really brought in as a co-founder to figure out all that early strategy and nomenclature for the product and to interview, you know, agencies and brands to see if it was even viable. But I was, you know, lockstep with a couple of engineers in the early days of that company. And then we did get a couple of clients to sign on, but we raised $10 million in venture capital pre-Lehman Brothers. We literally, the wire went through, I think it was August of that year. So we got really lucky that we were able to close $10 million in VC money right before the Lehman event. And I bring that up because it was very different in raising capital this time around. So this time around, we had to have a lot more traction to close our Series A. It was a very different landscape.
Yeah, I can imagine that it was a substantially different landscape. I was watching last night a short show on Mark Cuban and how he sold his company to Yahoo back at the time. And of course, they're interviewing these folks after the fact, and they were interviewing his co-founder of Broadcast.com. And they were saying, yeah, you know, in hindsight, there was, I forget the phrase he used, but exponential amounts of stupidity happening at that point in the business cycle.
And I, you know, I would agree with that from the standpoint that even when I think about the $10 million we secured early in the history of Media 6 Degrees, I don't recall even being asked to prove that I had a pipeline of interested clients in the product. And as most of you, as I've, you know, since learned pitching a lot of VCs, as most of them will tell you, they invest in the people a lot more, that they weight that a lot more heavily than they do the idea itself. So they thought we had a good idea, but they were absolutely investing in myself and the other co-founders of the company. But at the time they gave us a $10 million check, we had no traction at all. So that was, you know, summer of 2008. With local response, I had to have I had almost $1 million of booked revenue before I was able to close my Series A. So it was quite a different landscape here.
So how much did you to book that $1 million? Was that all pre-sales, or did you actually take some of the money that you earned from the exit of your previous company and say, all right, I'm going to put this capital into the risk bucket. I'm going to pay to have something developed so that we can at least have a platform that does some basic level of something or other so that I can go out and get and use some of the relationships that I have to get some customers to sign on, or what did that look like?
Yeah, we basically had some angel money and some institutional money from a company that was a pivot. So prior to my joining, there was a company in place, but it had not earned any revenue to date. So I actually was introduced to this company through a VC who considered it to be a failed investment in his portfolio, and we were looking to pivot the company into what it is today. So we were able to take kind of the kernel of the idea and the data and figure out a way to turn this into a B2B ad network instead of a consumer play, which is its original origin. And I was able to leverage the relationships that I had in the industry to test out the platform. We had a lot of false starts on the technology. So at the end of the day, it was really all about relationships and my reputation for what I had done with the prior company and getting, you know, people to test us out and to even hear what I had to say.
So when you went back to these people who knew, liked you, and trusted you already, you said, hey, I'm working in this new project, and this is my vision for what it's going to do, and we have some software in place now, but it's not really quite right, but I'd like you to try it out and give me your feedback. Does that roughly what that conversation looked like?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, as you do in startups, you have an idea and you need to test it out to see if it's viable. So I was able to do that with a few clients, and then I realized the original idea didn't work and we couldn't scale the business with the original idea. So I actually stopped and put all outbound efforts to a halt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it takes a lot of courage to do that. It's the last thing my VCs wanted to hear. Mm-hmm. But we needed to retool what we were doing, and I wasn't about to risk any relationships that I had if the product wasn't working the way we had hoped. So I didn't actually need to take a break for that long. I figured out an idea and a way to kind of rejigger what we were doing, and we were able to get back out in market within a couple of months. And that was really a turning point for the business. It was kind of the heartbeat. The heart started beating again, and we started to generate some some decent revenues. And then I started to feel like, okay, maybe I can turn this around. Maybe I can turn this into something. But that's typical for a startup to kind of have a lot of near-death experiences along the way. And so that's, you know, definitely something that happened here. And I would say that, you know, stopping and taking stock, if it's not working, is really important to do, even though it's scary at the time.
Yeah, I would imagine that was a pretty incredible phone call to have to make. I don't imagine that the VC's immediate response was, hey, Kathy, great idea. Yeah, go ahead and stop selling. Was there pushback? Was it strong?
We were also in the middle of, these were our seed investors, but we were also in the middle of trying to close on our Series A. So the timing probably couldn't have been worse. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, you know, it's just not worth risking your relationships if you aren't happy with the way the product is performing. And we're operating with integrity, you know, I was able to salvage any relation, you know, there was some clients running with us, and I actually stopped the campaigns from running to try to retool. And clients really appreciate that level of integrity and honesty in our space.
Yeah, I'll bet they do. So let's talk, because I am not an ad tech expert by any stretch of the imagination. I'm sure that several, if not the majority of the audience listening, is not. So I want to talk about your product for a little minute before we come back to building the business. So what is it? What the heck does this thing do?
Yeah, so Local Response is a company that is really, what we're doing is we're looking at and analyzing commercial intent that people might be expressing through social media. So, for example, you could tweet that you are looking for new jeans, or you could check in using, let's say, a platform like Foursquare into a Levi's store, or you could share an article about clothing and maybe comment on it. We're taking all of this commercial intent that's publicly expressed and turning that into targetable impressions for brands. So what that essentially means is if you're Levi's and someone has expressed all of these things through multiple social media outlets, you would be very interested in serving an ad to that person based on, you know, again, these public expressions. So we call all of this intent targeting, and our clients are predominantly agencies that serve, you know, Fortune 500 brands.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me boil that down, make sure that I and everyone else listening understood it. You have built a platform that allows you to essentially listen to I'll use the term conversations or posts, whatever you would like to say, things that people are saying on various social media platforms. So you're able to listen to all that. And then for where it is relevant for things that would be of interest to one of your clients, when an individual makes that tweet or that post or what have you, in some way, shape, or form, you're able to serve them up an ad as they browse going forward?
That's right. Exactly.
Okay. And that's done. I'm a little bit interested. Can you explain the technology that makes that happen without losing us and without taking 25 minutes to do it?
So it's basically, we are, like you said, listening and analyzing and distilling all of these data signals. And we use data science to do that. In terms of, you know, the proprietary distillation of information is really where you are able to build a company of value. Uh-huh. So that's what we do here internally, and that's where data science really comes to play. And, you know, we're looking at the recency of someone's posts, the frequency of their posts, and the strength of what we call a signal to really weight prospects for brands in terms of, you know, the strength of the signal, and kind of a composite of social signals is really what we're looking at.
Okay.
To be able to target someone with an ad.
Okay. And that makes sense. I couldn't, you know, code that to save my life, but I couldn't code anything. So that's not really much to be surprised at, but I can see how now why you've been able to grow so quickly, because as a brand, and my agency is going to come to me and say, hey, Trent, I have this tool that we can use to make sure that we serve up ads of yours that are super targeted and relevant to people that are expressing commercial intent related to a purchase of stuff like yours. I mean, who would say no to that? Because I don't have to. Am I paying as the brand? I guess I'm probably paying for impressions, or am I paying for clicks?
You are. You're paying for impressions. And you know what's important to note about this, our technology, is that the signals are very declarative in nature. So if you're a brand, you know, you would obviously like to target someone who has, you know, said something so declarative that you know that they're in market, they're really raising their hand to be served an ad that's highly relevant to them.
Mm-hmm. How many engineers did it take? I mean, because you undoubtedly are relying on a number or maybe a huge amount of complex algorithms to make all of this listening stuff happen so that the data that you collect on the individuals is actually relevant. I'm curious, like, how many people does it take to figure out a problem like that?
So we have 35 employees. We're headquartered in New York City. And we have in-market sales reps in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Chicago, soon to be Detroit and Boston. And we're growing. We're hiring every day.
Yeah.
So I think by the end of the year, we'll probably be around 45 to 50 people.
And 3 years from now, what does your plan look like? How big do you think you can get?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. We're the space that we're in is evolving so quickly. I think that we're only really able to plan roughly like a year to a year and a half out at most. This year we are hoping to double revenue. So that's definitely the trajectory we want to see in ad tech, we're trying to go from 10 million to 20 million, mm-hmm. which is a huge mountain to climb, but that's what we're trying to do in 2014.
And in ad tech, when you talk about that amount of revenue, are the margins razor thin because you're taking just a tiny little slice of the media spend?
Yeah, great question. Our margins are actually well above industry standard currently. And I think that we, as we add new data sources in to the company, that'll change a little bit and probably normalize. But ad tech standards on the ad network side are roughly 40% margin or maybe less in some cases. So we're well above that.
Wow. Well, that's pretty good then. No wonder the VCs like a business like yours.
Right.
All right. So let's move away from the tech speak and back to the story of the business. As I'm looking at your homepage, there's the who's who of brands there. There's EA Sports, Nike, Audi, Comcast, AT&T, Walgreens, HBO, Coca-Cola, P&G, Virgin Mobile, the list goes on and on and on. I asked you in the pre-interview, I said, are you doing content marketing to attract these brands? And you said no, and you're primarily an outbound firm. And so I want to take the opportunity to talk about this for a while because 99% of the interviews that I do are really all about inbound. And in my own business, I actually combine inbound and outbound because I used to be an outbounder long before inbound was ever invented. So you leverage relationship. Your conduit to these brands, as you explained it to me, is by way of the agencies that deal with them. So your job isn't to necessarily contact Audi, but to contact the agency that handles Audi's account, correct?
Yeah, that's typically how campaigns are executed in our space. I would say that we do try to what we call surround the sale. So we will contact Audi direct just so that they're aware of our offering and can guide the agency. Usually clients will ask the agency to test us when we have a meeting with them direct. So we do like to, as I said, surround the sale with meeting with client direct as well as the agencies. But ultimately in our game, the agencies, the media shops are the people that actually execute on media campaigns on behalf of brands. So I would say probably 98% of our clients and our revenue is flowing through the agencies.
Okay. So how do you go about contacting a brand? I mean, you just have your sales team sit there just hammering out cold calls all day, every day, or is there a more laser-like way that you're getting in the door?
I would say that relationships play a huge part in our business. The people that we hire usually have to have a book of relationships that they come with. So they would need to know people at different agencies that they can, you know, get a meeting with because they do have that relationship. And now that they're representing a new product at Local Response, you know, these are people that are going to take your call and take your meeting. So that's really key for us, is the relationship. This is really a relationship business. So there is a level of cold calling, or, you know, it's really emailing in our space. Nobody picks up their phone anymore, actually. So we are doing a lot of cold emailing. And, you know, it's a volume game as well. So for us, getting as many what's called an RFP, so request for proposal, getting on as many RFPs as we possibly can is the way that we ultimately, you know, can hit our targets. So it's definitely a volume business. Having a number of meetings every week or a number of calls add up to RFPs. And that means, you know, dollars for us. Our win rate is very high, meaning we win about 50% of what we pitch. So that's pretty good in our space. I'd say industry average is about 25%. And I think that really speaks to the uniqueness of our offering and our platform. And that helps us get meetings as well.
Yeah, I would imagine that it does. So in the funnel, from starting with cold email through to meeting, what do some of the conversion statistics look like? For example, how many, does it go cold email, phone call, meeting? Is that typically the path?
I think the sales team would love if that was true, but it's the team. I have some stats on this actually, but the team probably is chasing a client, you know, at least 5 to 10 times possibly before they can get a meeting if they don't have a prior relationship.
Yeah.
And then once we have a meeting, it's almost always in person, and that's really important in our business to meet someone in person. So it's hardly ever we're hardly ever pitching over the phone. And then the chase begins to get included on an opportunity for a particular campaign. So there's a level of chasing involved all along the sales cycle for us, and it can take anywhere from, you know, from initial email through to closure. You know, our average sales cycle is probably 2 to 3 months, I would guess.
Okay. And I know you're probably not, you know, the one in charge of the sales department, but I'm going to ask these questions anyway in the hopes that you can provide answers. The cold emails that are going in, because this is something that would be directly applicable to my audience, and that's why I'm going down this rabbit hole. What do they look like? I mean, are you sending emails to pieces of content that provide education around your topic, or are you, like, what do they say in the email?
Typically, they're really, really short. The people that we're emailing are inundated with inquiries from vendors like us that want a meeting or want to take up their time with a meeting. So for us, it has to be really, really short, to the point, and really demonstrating quickly. I mean, within one or two sentences, by the way, by short. But demonstrating quickly how we can add value to their client. You know, how can we solve a problem that they need to solve for their client, and or like a quick idea about how our technology can apply to that particular client. And then requesting, this is key for us too, is requesting a very short meeting. So we don't want to take up a lot of their time. 15 to 20 minutes is what I always ask for. Of course, we end up staying longer, and that's okay. That means they're interested. But, you know, it's got to be really short. It's got to be to the point, and we have to be requesting a very small window on their calendar to be heard.
Do you think that it is as much the frequency of these emails that are requesting that meeting as the actual two sentences in the subject line that makes the individual emails themselves?
Yeah, I think it's both. I think that we have to be relevant for them to not just hit delete, but also it does require a level of frequency to cut through the clutter. As I said, I can't even imagine how many emails these clients are getting on a daily basis, but it's a tremendous amount, you know, in terms of the companies that must be calling on them every day to request their time. It's just a tremendous amount to weed through. So frequency is also important for us. We do try to send, something of value with an email. So it may be a case study that's relevant to the brand that they work on. It may be results of what we've done for a competitor to that brand, anything to catch their attention. But again, it has to be relevant.
So these aren't broadcast emails. These are sales reps custom. On your end writing two or three custom sentences every single time they hit the send button.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're okay. The only thing that might be repeated is, you know, what we do. So it might be one line about what Local Response can do, but the rest of it is customized for that particular brand.
And who in the receiving organization, your prospect, who do you reach out to? The CMO typically?
Yes. If it's on the client side, it'll be the CMO or the VP of marketing. If they have it siloed, it'll be the VP of digital marketing in our case, because we're a digital play. And then on the agency side, it'll be anyone on the media team. So media supervisor, media director, media planner, kind of all levels of that particular team, because those are the people that control the ad dollars for that particular brand.
Okay. And how do you guys get the email address, or are they very easy to come by?
Oh, that's a good question. We there's a lot of sharing in our business. You know, a lot of companies do help each other out. You know, all the people that work for me here have a lot of friends that might pass on an email address of someone that works on a particular account at a particular agency. And, you know, there's a lot of that going on, as well as, like I said, the relationships. But LinkedIn is incredibly helpful. It is one of the most helpful tools in our space. It's easy for us to look up people that work at particular agencies and figure out what accounts that they work on. So LinkedIn has been an incredibly powerful tool. And there's something else called Seller Crowd. I think I'm getting the name right here. But Seller Crowd is particular for people that work in the ad targeting space. And it's free. What people post there are people that work on, you know, the ad targeting side of the business, and they may post a question about a particular opportunity. Does anyone know who works on Audi at MediaCom? That could be a question. And it's just a tool that sellers use to help each other with information and knowledge.
Okay.
So, and emails.
Light, typical day in the life of one of your sales reps is they're sitting there in front of their screen and they're spending all this time researching on LinkedIn and firing out email after email after email. And every once in a while, those emails are turning into an opportunity to go and do a pitch in person. Is it the same person that's sending all the emails is going to do the meeting, or do you delineate that?
Yeah, it is the same person, actually. So we have, and like I said, it's important that we build relationships with our clients. So we need it to be the same person that has sent the email that is actually making the sales call in person, so that they can develop a relationship with that media person on the other end. So it's all the same person for us. It would be odd. I know some people do this, but it'd be odd in our business to have an inside salesperson that you know, just sends the emails but doesn't actually make the sales call. Just because this is a relationship business and you really want to get to know people on an individual basis.
Okay.
So that would be a strange handoff for us. That wouldn't really work.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that your meetings are very, very short. So unlike a typical consultative sell where you're spending the vast majority of time asking questions to understand the needs, wants, and desires of your potential customer, so that when you do actually get to talking about your stuff, you can super tailor your message.
Right.
Do you follow that same format and just cram it into 20 minutes, or do you basically have a deck that you go out with because your stuff is kind of so new, or not so new maybe as much as so different than other things they're doing, and you're really just trying to say, hey, our stuff is really different. Here's how it works.
Yeah, we do need materials because it is technology. So to your point before, we need to be able to explain how we do what we do. And so we have, we use PowerPoint. We do, however, try to get to the point very quickly. I will say that because these folks that we call on are so incredibly busy, that I feel like after 5 minutes, you are probably losing their attention if you're still talking. So we definitely like to have our value prop, covered in 5 minutes or less, and then turn the rest of the meeting into a conversation about how we can help them.
Okay. All right. So you're sort of doing it a little bit in reverse, but only so as to give them a reason to want to continue on to dive deeper into the conversation part of the sales call.
Right, exactly. And to also make sure that if you only have 20 minutes to a half hour of someone's time, that you're able to spend the majority of that meeting talking about their business and how what we can do to help.
Mm-hmm. With respect to the sales and customer acquisition side of your business, Kathy, what haven't I asked you that would make this conversation that you and I are having richer for the people that are listening to it? Anything?
I guess, the point about being able to be flexible with what you're selling and working within, the changing, we have a very dynamic landscape that we're working within. So we're very adaptable to change as a startup, which you have to be. And I think that recognizing, the change in maybe demands that your clients have and meeting those demands is very, very important for, your survival and to be able to thrive. So in our space, about 90% of companies fail.
Mm-hmm.
So for us to stay in the 10%, we need to be consistently innovating. We need to be consistently staying ahead of our competitors, but we also need to be, adaptable and, keeping our ear to the ground about changes because, again, our landscape is changing so quickly every day that that's really important for us to be able to adapt.
So you'd mentioned in the pre-interview that content marketing isn't a big part of what you're doing to attract leads and customers now. And I'm curious, are you familiar with a company by the name of HubSpot?
No.
Okay. So they make content marketing software and software as a service. 2.5 years ago, they were doing 20 million. This year, it's 100 million. They're based in Boston. Fairly big success story. And they're generating 50,000 leads a month from their blog. And they have one of the most popular marketing blogs on the planet. There's thousands and thousands of posts. They have a team of writers dedicated to writing. Their agency partners make guest contributions. Suffice to say, or what I'm trying to say, is their blog has played a huge role in their success because of the quantity of leads that it generates.
Right.
Is that on the roadmap for you guys? Content marketing is hot. Everybody and their dog is producing, and I'm obviously a flag waving member of that club because that's how I build my businesses as well. Is content marketing something that's even on the roadmap for you guys? Because I got to think around the topic that your expertise in software is, there's a million questions that people have. There's a huge opportunity for blog posts.
Agree, 100%. I think that's an area where we've been so heads down building the business that we need to now kind of come above ground and really establish ourselves as thought leaders in this space. I mean, a lot of our clients look at us as the forefront, and we are not doing a good job of producing any content around what we think about the industry and why this is an evolution of other methods of targeting that clients could, potentially use and utilize. So I would say that that's kind of an area where we're kind of falling down. Even our website's kind of a couple of splash pages, doesn't go into a lot of detail about what we do. Mm-hmm. So we're the typical, cobbler whose children has no shoes, or however that saying goes.
Mm-hmm.
We are very lightweight currently on putting out white papers and thought leadership even on our website, and also just, kind of out into the ecosystem. So I would say that's an area that we need to improve on this year. I did just hire a VP of marketing, so that's going to be a big part of her role. It's just an issue that none of us on the management team had time. No one had time to really even put what we think down on paper.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be something that she's going to be driving for us. Thought leadership is going to be a huge initiative for us in 2014.
Okay. Well, let's finish off the interview with going back and just talking about the financing. You'd mentioned way early on in this interview that raising money in 2000 and did you do your Series A in 2013? 12,
14? We closed on our Series A in the fall of 2011.
Okay. So a little while ago now, but the process for you was much, much, much different than it was back in 2008. For the other entrepreneurs who are listening to this, who are looking to raise money, what advice would you give them? What are they going to need to have in place before they would have even a snowball's chance in hell of doing a Series A round?
Yeah, I think traction with your customer base is huge. We needed some seed money so that we could actually hire people, you know, to create that velocity in the beginning. So I would say getting, you know, either whether it's friends and family or angel money just to get your company off the ground, but then getting as much traction as you can in the marketplace to be able to prove to an institutional investor that you have a market for what you're doing. That's key. It's really difficult unless you're a consumer company to actually secure venture capital. When you're a B2B play like we are, ad targeting is all B2B. You really need to prove that you have a customer, there's customer demand for what you do, and you need to be able to prove that it's different from anything else out there because the landscape is so overcrowded and oversaturated. So those are kind of the keys. We had to have clients locked in spending money with us to be able to secure our Series A.
Was it important the amount of total revenue or the delta from quarter to quarter? Which did the VCs pay more attention to?
Really the delta. I'm just showing that we had, you know, the traction that we were building upon was really important and that was an upward trend. So they definitely want to see a hockey stick and they want to understand who is the addressable audience for your business and how big is it? How big is the market and how fast can you capture a good, you know, chunk of that market. So all, you know, venture capitalists definitely want to hear across the board, how can you create velocity in the shortest amount of time? Because all they're thinking about is when are they going to get their money back?
Yeah. And for you as the entrepreneur who has now got a new set of bosses called VCs, they give you a term sheet at the beginning. Is it pretty common that if you essentially fail to hit your numbers, that they have the option of replacing you and you're going to walk away with essentially almost nothing?
That's a great question. Now I have to knock on wood because I haven't been in that position yet in either of my companies. But I would say that, you know, sure, if you're not hitting the marks and they're not seeing what they want to see, you probably will be replaced at some point. And you usually, if you've negotiated well when you joined the company or founded the company and put the terms together, you're not walking away with zero. You have some equity in the company because you have contributed something to the foundation of the company. So I think that usually in that instance where founding CEOs are asked to leave, they're usually left with some equity in the company because they did, you know, like I said, create a foundation for the beginning. Mm-hmm. They just might not be the person to take it to the next level.
Yeah, which is probably not that uncommon. All right, Kathy, is there anything else that I haven't asked you or any topics that you'd like to talk about before we wind up the interview?
I guess the only thing that I would like to end with is just, you know, my motto throughout my whole life has always been feel the fear and do it anyway. And I've, you know, throughout the course of building two companies, you know, you have your moments where you're really afraid that you're not going to make it happen. But I push through those and I, you know, ultimately I don't spend any energy on why something can't be done. I put all of my energy into figuring out how it can be done.
That is a very, very good piece of advice. Actually, one other question just came to mind. When you take VC money, your personal lifestyle, I mean, are they expecting that you're going to be working 100-hour weeks? What does it look like to actually be in your shoes?
Yeah, I think they definitely do. The good thing is I would say that they're not necessarily watching over your shoulder if you're making it happen. Mm-hmm. They start to micromanage you when, you know, they think the wheels are coming off the bus. And eventually, if they write you off as a failed investment, they don't return your calls anymore. But if you're making it happen, generally, you know, they are technically your bosses, but they're not, you know, watching over you day to day. So you do have a fair amount of freedom to work as, you know, hard as you need to make it happen. So I think in general, the feeling is as long as it's happening, they don't really need to know how many, you know, hours you could be working till 10 o'clock one night and 6 o'clock the next night. But as long as you're you know, getting it done and innovating, that would be, you know, the key to any VC.
And how about for you? I mean, you're kind of getting it to got done. To go to past 10 million in 3 years is getting it done. How many hours a week do you have to work now?
I probably work, I think, probably 60, 70 hours a week, I would say.
Okay.
So. And I have a four-year-old, so it's difficult. I wouldn't say that balance is a word I would use, but, you know, I think that I'm trying. I'm pretty good at, I try to be good at actually turning off, you know, I turn off my phone on the weekend so I can really focus on my daughter. So I'm not one of those people that's constantly on my phone texting and emailing. I think it's important to kind of take a break from technology, even though I work in it. Mm-hmm. I believe that you should turn off your phone and focus on living. So I'm able to switch on and off pretty good. But that said, at 1 o'clock in the morning on Saturday night, I was working. So maybe I'm not doing such a great job. But yeah, it's hard because you're married to both, right? You're married to your family and you're married to the work. So
yep.
I think the key is being passionate about what you do, because then it doesn't feel like work as much.
I agree. Having been an entrepreneur now for 14, 15 years, probably like you and every other entrepreneur listening to this, I work harder for myself than I ever would for anyone else, but I can't fathom ever being an employee again and somebody saying, this is how much you're going to make, this is your job description, this is how many weeks vacation you get.
Absolutely, 100%. I mean, I think now that I've crossed over, I'm definitely not looking back.
Yeah. All right, Kathy, thank you so much for being a guest here on the show with me. If people do want to get a hold of you, what is the one easiest way for them to do that?
Definitely email. So my email is Kathy, K-A-T-H-Y, at localresponse.com.
All right. Thank you so much for being a guest. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. To get to the show notes for today's episode, go to brightideas.co/136. And if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment and help me to spread the word. You can easily do that by going to brightideas.co/love, where there is a pre-crafted tweet awaiting the click of your mouse, and it will be off into the Twitter stream. So that's it for this host. That's it for this episode. I am your host, Trent Dearsmid. Thank you so much for tuning in to the podcast. I look forward to having you back for another episode soon. Take care.
Thanks very much for listening to the Bright Ideas Podcast. Check us out on the web at brightideas.co.
All right, show's over. I'm tired.